The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization that more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here might be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Brian Unger, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. This meeting is two 10-minute speakers, followed by a main speaker. Speaker, please note you'll be given a 5-minute and a 1-minute reminder when it is time to wrap up your talk. Our first 10-minute speaker is Paul F.
Hello, my name is Paul Fiddler, and I'm an alcoholic. I don't see myself or anybody else. Okay, there you go. I've been sober since June 9th, 1988, EA class of 88. I've been in the group since 1994, an active member of PG since 1994. You know, growing up, I didn't really feel comfortable. I felt different than my fellows, I guess. I sometimes felt better than, sometimes felt worse than, and I was always comparing. And I could never really be at one with anybody. But growing up, I found that I was good at sports. And when I was excelling on the ball field of some sort, I sort of evened things out. And when I was doing something spectacular, it could make me even. You know, I always had sort of a self-esteem issue. So if I wasn't doing better than everybody else, I was doing worse than in my head. So I played football, I played baseball, I played basketball, I played, you know, all the sports that are out there. I was usually the first or second best person on the team all the time. My dad was a college quarterback at a small college. He wanted me to do better than he did. So he was grooming me for that. And I fell into that dream, and I sort of followed that along. And I was the quarterback through Pop Warner. I was about to go into high school. And the year before I went into high school, I went and saw one of the high school games, and the quarterback there scrambled out of trouble, threw a pass from his own 20-yard line to the other 20-yard line. And it never got over 12 feet off the ground. And I went, oh my God, I am not a quarterback. And I never played another down of football in my life. You know, I didn't know John Elway was going to be that good, but that's who the quarterback was that day. I would have been the quarterback after John Elway. And that wasn't going to suit with me well. I don't like to look silly or stupid. And that's, so I just never played football again. I solved that problem. I felt out of sorts for a while because I had nothing to make me stand out from my peers again until I found music and I started playing bass in a rock band. And I did the same thing with that. When I got off the stage, yes, I could be even and comfortable, but with my peers, but otherwise I felt a little bit less than, except when I drank. And when I drank, all that went away and I could be with you. I could be just like anybody else, you know, and I was really comfortable when I was drinking. Only problem is, so I drank a lot. And lucky being a rock band, that's kind of almost accepted. At least at that point it was. But eventually I had some problems with that. I was the bass player that was falling into the drum kit, you know, during a gig, you know, or spinning around and almost knocking my lead singer out with the head of my bass by, you know, just not paying attention where I'm going. And so it was having its problems. And then it was having problems with me and the bandmates that I was with. You know, if I'm showing up drunk at the gigs or getting drunk at the gigs, I would get cut off. If we were playing like top 40 or something like that, in a bar, within a couple of days, they would cut me off from not give free drinks like they were giving everybody else. So I would beg people from the audience to buy me drinks. We'll play any song you want if you buy me a drink, you know, type of thing. So we were doing those type of things. I also was trying to go to school, and it was affecting me that way as well. As you know, I was going to school in the afternoon, trying to go to college, and I just had a bad record at college because of the fact that I do well for a semester, and then I'd fall behind and can't catch back up because of the amount of partying I was doing, and it'd drop out. There was one time I was in a sociology class, and my hand just couldn't stop shaking. And I was, you know, I drank for, you know, 5 days straight, and I wasn't drinking that day. And it was late in the afternoon, and I heard somebody from behind me say, "Psst, what's wrong with that guy?" And that did it. I can't look silly or stupid. So I just closed my books, walked out of the class, and never came back to that class again. Obviously I got a fail. But that was one way to solve it. So it was affecting me in that area too. It really kind of came to a head when I was trying to stop drinking. I would try to stop drinking, and when I tried, then I realized I couldn't. My whole life I was told by my father that you can do anything you want to as long as you put your mind to it. Well, that didn't seem to be possible with this. I just kept going out and going out and going out over and over again after I was trying. I didn't really join AA at that point. So things kept getting worse, and I had a guitar player, a friend of mine that was chipping on heroin. So I figured, well, I can't not do anything. So I tried to give up alcohol and the white powdery substances that was causing me the most of my problem. And I thought I could chip on heroin just once a month to take the edge off. Well, that didn't work out too well. I ended up selling every piece of musical equipment I had. One of the first pieces was when a band I was in was having a showcase for a record company, and like 3 days, 4 days beforehand, I sold off my guitar. That didn't really bode well for that, for that presentation, that showcase. I eventually figured out that this wasn't the right thing. I actually tried to kill myself by taking a whole mess of Quaaludes and drinking down with alcohol. It didn't work. Obviously, I'm here. And when I actually came to and noticed what was going on, was I was in St. John's detox, St. John's CDC unit in the hospital there in Santa Monica. And that started my road to recovery. I had one more little venture to see whether there was something else out there before I came back and said, went to cry help and got sober there. You know, at the time when I was very active between years one and three, and then I fell off and didn't go out, but it was very inactive between three and six. And what I can tell you is that doesn't really work well for if you're a real alcoholic like me. I just went nuts. I started doing things that I was doing. I was getting fist fights over who was going to go out, who was going to drive that evening. I got a promotion at work, and I didn't know whether I can handle that promotion. So I just couldn't sleep that whole night. And then I fell asleep right before it was time to get up, I guess. And I woke up and it was like midday, and I didn't know what to do. So I didn't go into work. I didn't call, and I didn't go in the next day. Well, that took care of that promotion. And that's in sobriety, not going to meetings. And that's the kind of person that showed up to actually somebody from my past that knew me in earlier sobriety, came back into town and said, "What is wrong with you?" And she turned me over to a member of PG and said, "Take, you know, help him or I'll kill you," is basically what she told him. And so that person took me to PG meetings, and I started becoming active in this group, and my life started slowly getting better. You know, I wasn't that, before people were calling me fuse box because they never knew what I was going to blow. And I don't think anybody here would call me that. You know, that's not the persona I put out there anymore. You know, I have a program that allows me to deal with the issues that come up, and I don't get to the point where I just bury it and blow up. As I said earlier, that I always was trying to do something extraordinary to feel even. working the program got me to the point, just like alcohol did, is that it didn't really matter anymore. It's not that I don't care what you guys think about me, but I'm okay with myself, you know, and that's the most important thing that I could actually find and actually get out of this program. And that's what I received. I don't do sports anymore. Well, I do golf, and Morgan can tell you that I'm not good at that. But that's whatever. I did play softball for many, many years, part of PG. So that came around full circle. I'm now teaching college. And so that came around full circle. So instead of being the college student, I'm the professor. So AA works in that regard. I'm not really in music anymore, but Joyce and I have won a couple of air guitar trophies. So, you know, there, put your hat on that. And I don't know, that things came around and my life got better and I'm joyed where I'm at. So thank you very much for having me share.
Thank you. Our second 10-minute speaker is Cecilia C.
Good evening. My name is Cece. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 28, 1989. My sponsor is Rita R. My grand sponsor is Judy R. And the Pacific Group is my home group. I'd like to thank you all for allowing me to share my story with you and for me to participate in my recovery. For those who are new and returning, we welcome you back and to tell you that you don't ever have to drink again. It's not an option. I'm originally from New York. I was brought up in a foster home. There were six of us, and I was the youngest of six. We did the normal things, like go to church, school, stuff like that. My mother was what we call a strict disciplinarian. And I was always getting in fights, and she was always having to whip my butt. I have a problem with anger, and that had a tendency to make me get unstable and out of control. However, I cherished the times that we had together, my mother and I, when we were just in the kitchen talking. I would clean up as she cooked. We just had a good old time. And when I was 13, that all changed. I developed. Boys started noticing me. I started noticing them. And around that time, that's when my uncle, my foster sister, and foster brother started molesting me. They would tell me that this is our secret, not to tell anybody. And if I did, they wouldn't believe me anyway. I was also around the time when I took my first drink. I had gone to a party with some friends of mine from school and from the neighborhood. A drink was handed to me. I took the drink. I didn't like the way it tasted, but I liked the way it felt going down. That warm ease and comfort. It made me not to feel or care. You could say I drank for the effect. At 18, I dropped out of school. And at 20, I left for good. That's when my alcoholism really took off. Like a bat out of hell. I was what you call true to form. Self will run riot. Full flight from reality. And a mental defective. I did whatever it took when I was out there. Prostitution, stealing, whatever it took to get me where I need to be. I got beat down, body slammed. I was hurting. I was in that much pain. I just didn't know how to tell anybody. That's where my alcoholism took me. That's how far down I went. In 88, I tried AA. And I managed to put together 10 months. But to be honest with you, I was more dry than I was sober. And I did not take those three essentials, honesty, open-minded, and willingness, because I was none of those things. And I had to go back out and test the waters one more time just to find out there was nothing out there for me. So when I came back in March 28th of 89, I crawled back in the rules of AA, on my hands and knees, with my tail between my legs, and you welcomed me back. You asked me three questions. And the three questions were, one, how willing are you to get and stay sober? Two, what lengths are you willing to go to do that? And three, how free do you want to be? As I said, in 88, I quit. But in 89, when I came back, I surrendered. I got a sponsor. I came to meetings. I was on time. I was told to do that, sit in the front. And things got better. My sponsor is a PG sponsor. And she introduced me to PG. And what I did is I stood in line. I shook everybody's hand. When I came inside, I did the literature commitment with my sponsor first. Then I took a coffee commitment. And then I became like a runner. Like whenever there was a commitment available, I was there. I've had a lot of fun. When I took my 30-year cake and I got down off that stage, Clancy held his hand out to me and congratulated me and told me many more. And I was also involved in a play they had. And the Christmas chorus. And I met a lot of good people in PG. Yeah. One of the things I was told when I first got here was to introduce myself. Let people know who I was. Get numbers of five women and call them every day. And that's what I've done. And I've never had it so good. I've gone back to school. This is what it's like for me today. I've gone back to school. I've gone back to church. I've done that as an amends to myself. And I never had it so good. So for you guys that are new, just keep doing what got you here. Just keep doing what got it good. And stick around. Hopefully you will find what I have found. And keep coming back, because without you, there is no me. Thank you.
Thank you. Our main speaker tonight is Wendy T.
My name is Wendy. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be here, and I'm grateful to be sober. And my give you some of the vitals. Vitals is my friend of my sponsors. She is. My sobriety date is August 10th, 2003. My home group is the Do It Sober group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor is here in this room, which gives you a stronger likelihood of the truth, Gemma B. I find those three things to be vital. My age is 52, also something I always wonder about if you're new here in the room, and in particular, if you are enjoying a little judgment, which is one of my favorite activities. If you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you. This is the absolute best thing I never knew, I always wanted. I believe firmly, completely, and have drank the Kool-Aid to the fact that I really highly doubt that I am alive or free on the face of this earth without AA. I've been given the keys to the kingdom and the opportunity to grow up. I want to thank Marty for asking me to participate in my society. And I want to thank Georgia for being so warm and welcoming today. And I adore Georgia. Just any conversation with her is a gift. And I want to say thank you to Piper for singing to me in the breakout room just before I spoke, because that definitely took the nerves out of it. I thought that maybe sharing at the Pacific group would be a little less intimidating on Zoom. I was wrong. The power of the Pacific group is still the power of the Pacific group. You know, the message carriers that carried the message to me in my new arrival to Alcoholics Anonymous were folks that were members of PG. And it just, it's a powerful expression of this message that, you know, that so many of you are here. So many of you aren't here, which also kind of makes me sad. There's some amazing members that are spirits and not in this room tonight, but I probably will have stolen some of their material, so they will reemerge. And I also would like to just let you guys know that I am in the process and currently on chemo. And I share with you that fact because if you hear me kind of blank out for a second, which is going to happen and valid, it's because I'm sort of experiencing at a new level this sort of, why did I walk in this room? It comes back. It's momentary. But just to let you know, that's what's going on. My job here when I share from the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous is to, or the Zoom of Alcoholics Anonymous, is to share with you my experience, strength, and hope. To share with you what I have done a day at a time to take the absolute perfect principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, the 12 concepts, the warranties, if you're that heady, what I have done to take these ideals and apply them to the life of an alcoholic with feet of clay. And I'm going to do my best to do that. In the words of my friend Patty O, she used to always share with me before I would get up and talk, she would say, Wendy, you know, tell them your story and tell the truth, kind of a thing. And I got to tell you, and then she would follow it up with, I told you my name. I don't know if I'm going to tell you the truth. I have found that the person I lie to the most is me. And the steps have helped me, without managing my life as much, live a little closer to the truth of who and what I am. There's a lot of friends I have here tonight that are supporting, of which one of the women that's here is the woman who drove me to detox. I want to just shout out to Anne. Thank you for showing up. Also, another reason I have to tell the truth, and Cindy, and just a lot of people. So thank you for showing up. I got to tell you, as much as in person, PG was always the gold standard of just the gold standard of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous for me. You continue to do it with Zoom. And like, what an amazing gift you know, servants like Morgan are, you know, that just kind of like that power moves through and you continue to make a meeting with 975 people possible. And someone who's, Morgan actually assisted us in throwing a convention down here on Zoom, teaching us all the things and the gadgets and the wizards. And I got to tell you, it's a difficult thing. It's not an easy thing. So just really impressed. So anyway, let me get to it. We're done. My experience is this. About a month before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was drinking 2 cases of beer a day. I'd come to at around 5 a.m. And I'd putz around in the house and maybe I'd be wearing 3, 4, 5 days worth of the same clothes. They'd be covered in urine or vomit or blood. And I would either play on the computer or I would watch television. I drunk dial. There just was, I was past the point where it was fun to try. It was much fun to go and try to be out with other people. I was constantly getting, you know, thrown out of places gently. But because, you know, usually they found me on the floor and would sort of drag me out. I was constantly being asked to not show up at family functions or friends' houses when events were going on because I was too much. When I drank, I was your responsibility. I was just kind of a sloppy mess of a lump of lard drunk. And, so I really would just kind of conserve it to the house at the end. And, you know, I would maybe black out at around noon. I'd come to again at 5 a.m., at 5 p.m. and just not know if it was 5 a.m. or 5 p.m. And I would do my absolute best to make sure that that second case of beer would last until 6 in the morning. Because if not, I could very easily in my head justify knocking on neighbors' doors to get more beer. That was what it was like. I mean, I would after now, here's the thing that nearly got me when I first got to AA. When I first got here, one of the things that I saw as a difference between you and me is that it sounded to me like you guys all got here. You know, you started drinking when you were 9 and you got to Alcoholics Anonymous sometime in your early 30s. And you were drinking a handle of vodka from the time that you started drinking to the time that you got here every day. My experience wasn't that. There was a progression. And even though I read the book pieces that seemed to say that, you know, some people, you know, it's a, oops, lost the keys to the Mercedes. I'm going to AA, which is valid. You know, if you've hit your bottom, you've hit your bottom. Outside circumstances and conditions may be different. But I just kind of judged, I was looking for the differences. And, the fact that I did not drink every day almost killed me. And you can ask Anne about that, but I, would maybe drink for 3 or 4 days at a time, 5 days max. And I would end up I would call an ambulance on myself and they would take me to the hospital and I would get, you know, I'd ride a gurney somewhere in the ER for 8-12 hours. They might do 1 or 2 banana bags, which are those vitamin electrolyte, you know, IVs. I might ride that out and start to feel ish better. And 1 of 2 things would happen for me at the end of that day. I would either say, you know, there's no point in trying anymore. My armistice day is already long past. I don't believe there's a stop in me. So why not just go to the bar, you know, call a cab and just start all over. Or I might have a rally of the troops and that one next rally of the troops, this time it's going to be different. This time I'm going to throw it into fifth gear. I'm going to sit up straight. I'm going to cross every T. I'm going to dot every I, and I'm going to do whatever I have to do to get perfect. And I'm going to make sure that I get home and I start cleaning. Always the first job. You know, I might throw out, there'd be like a saucepan of macaroni and cheese that turned to charcoal that I needed to, you know, toss. There'd be laundry that had been sitting in the washer completely soaking wet that I needed to either burn or start drying or rewash or whatever it was. I needed to pick up laundry because truly that's from the dry cleaners because I was just, you know, essentially giving them the dirty laundry to clean for me. I had to pay parking tickets, hundreds of dollars in parking tickets, because truly that was the cost of parking at the end of my drinking. And I was living on credit. I had been fired for embezzling money from the company I'd been working for. And I had the dream job. It was the job I'd been working for my whole life. And, I really had hit a bottom, you know, but I called a cab one day and the cab driver took me to, he was taking me to a high class establishment. It was like a bar in Pomona. Some of you may know it. It's called the Highbrow. It's behind a gas station. And as Patty used to say, it had that used boozed urine smell. And the jukebox, and you couldn't see anyone inside. And the regular showed up at 6 a.m. And oh, it just makes me smile thinking about it. It really does. Well, he took me there and he knew where he was taking me. And he was acting on 18 years of his primary purpose. And he's the guy who essentially got me in my first meeting. And I loved Alcoholics Anonymous from the moment I got here. I mean, everything about it. And I don't know why. I mean, it was this club that I first came to was this tiny little Alano club that was a space they rented in a business mall. You know, it had the popcorn ceiling and the linoleum floors and the metal folding chairs and the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, nicotine stained on the side of the wall. And there was a disco ball hanging from the center of the room because we are not glum. And there was a podium that was like particle board and it just was wiggling because it was about to break. But with an amateur acrylic painting of two hands praying that read underneath, "We care." And there was like a thumb moving in a direction the thumb shouldn't move. And I remember, you know, the cab driver, whose name was Jim, came and he grabbed my arm and he started walking me around and there's maybe six people there, fellows who would not mix. And he started introducing me and this is Wendy, she's new. And I knew he was just trying to get credit for the multi-level marketing scheme that this was for the religion that you guys had going on. And I didn't care. I mean, for me, I loved Alcoholics Anonymous. You knew how I drank. And I mean, it was like the place smelled like a burnt Folgers coffee pot that hadn't been cleaned for 30 years. I mean, it was like grocery store cookies that with frosting this thick, that wasn't even real frosting. It was pink. I will say that. And, but he's marching me around. He's introducing me to everyone. And he plops the big book down in front of me. And, I got to tell you, I just loved it, you know, but I was willing to tell you, whatever you needed to hear. I was willing to tell you whatever you needed to hear to be able to stay, but I wasn't really willing to do what you do. I knew I was going to run con because honestly, I didn't know different. I had been telling people what they wanted to hear my entire life. And, you know, I started drinking when I was maybe six. Like I started taking sips of my dad's beer. And then I started having experiences with, just the self-will, just the restlessness, the irritability, the discontentment, the restlessness, I'm not settled anywhere, the irritability, you're doing it wrong, the discontent, this isn't right, this isn't the right way. I am expert at finding what I think is wrong about everything that's going on when I really don't even know. And it takes a minute for me to kind of get centered and recognize that I don't know. I can be talking to myself in the car about and justifying, you know, why what you're doing is wrong and actually having a conversation with like an imaginary third party about you. And I'll get 5 seconds into the conversation and realize you have no idea what you're talking about. So, I mean, that awareness that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is a true gift, you know, but that ability to kind of depart into fantasy has always been there for me. And usually that departure is accompanied by, you know, me biting my fingernails until they bleed kind of a thing. So I was kind of a weird kid. I was a fat kid. There was issues. I had a mother who was incredibly uncomfortable with me being overweight. And I understand she was coming from a place of love. I really do believe that. But at the time, it didn't feel like that. And I'm governed by feelings. I am not governed by facts. And that's a challenge to this very day. So I remember that I got to, by the time I'm a teenager, you know, they're sending me out to get gym uniforms. And when they send me out to go get a gym uniform and I end up at the store in Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills, They didn't carry my size. Plus size wasn't a thing in 1983. And I just was, the shame of it was more than I could bear. You know, I was 250 pounds. I was 5'10". I had a just huge afro of hair by the time I'm, you know, 13, 14 years old. And you were all 5 foot tall. You were blonde hair and blue eyes. And I was certain you were nothing like me. And I was already at a place where I was convinced that I was the ugly stepchild. I did not fit in, that I knew I was a throwaway, that the things that were out there for me, that were out there for, in the future for you, were not going to be out there for me. There was going to be no husband. There was going to be no family. There was going to be no friends, that I was going to be a straggler. And I remember just choosing, you know, my solution, which is usually my solutions are worse than my problems frequently, if I choose of my own management to do what I'm thinking. And my thought was, I'm not going to gym class. And so I, you know, started going home and taking the top inch off every bottle and drinking for effect, you know, and I did that through high school. It progressed, you know, and it was like one coping skill begat another bad coping skill. It was another poor choice. It started with the drinking, and the drinking frequency included. My mother had a dental practice in Upland. And so when I realized it was hard to be the good student that I wanted to be during the week and just drink and party like a pig, to get some breathing room on the weekend, I would hit my mother's dental office and just kind of avail myself of a personal pharmacy of outside issues. And then, you know, I found boys, and that was a whole other just fountain of validation. And that's all I wanted. I wanted to hear that I wasn't a throwaway, that I wasn't a piece of shit. And then I was, you know, into an eating disorder to get more boys. And then there was stealing of credit cards and checks from my mother to accommodate the new clothes from the eating disorder that got me the more boys that I enjoyed while I was, you know, in lots of managed worlds. I definitely didn't let my good student friends know about my friends that I was hanging out with that had the mascara, the Knox gelatin mohawks, and the chained necklaces, or, you know, I didn't let them know. And I didn't let the friends that were in the corner parking lot, I felt that, you know, had my bad girl side, which is funny. My friend Andy says, I grew up in the rough streets of the mall, which is very true. And I didn't want them to know about the people, the social kids that I was hanging out with, the ones that got the good grades. So I had just lies going on everywhere. I would tell people what they wanted to hear. And I had my very first epiphany when it came to how to deal with it all, as the impending doom, impending sanity, impending poverty, everything started to descend on my shoulders, that I can't live this way anymore. It was take a trip. And I saw a flyer for becoming an exchange student. And before you know it, I was in Mérida de Venezuela, not of my choosing. They would pick where you would go. And I was there for a year to live with this family that I didn't know. I told them everything they wanted to hear, that it was about the transcript, that it was about learning a new culture, a language, or whatever it was. None of it was true. I had to get out. I didn't know what I had to get out of, you know? And within my first week in AA, someone said to me, wherever you go, there you are. I mean, that brilliance alone made AA so much. I was in love with AA. The very first one I ever got that hit me in the heart was, you know, when you're judging someone, you're pointing one finger at yourself and three back, and one finger at them and three back at yourself. And I thought, I mean, it was just like jaw dropping moments, you know? And the wisdom was just unreal when I first got here. But, you know, I get to Venezuela, and I try to throw it into fifth gear, and I'm going to sit up straight and fly right and cross every T and dot every I, and I'm not going to drink, and I'm not going to drink, and I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to take pills. I'm not going to do the funny cigarettes. I'm not going to be the town whore. I'm not going to do any of the stealing or bad checks. I'm going to do everything I can to sit up straight and right and be the good girl. All I want to do is be a good girl and get friends and feel like I could let you in. I mean, but the truth was, is that I didn't want to let you in until I felt like I was better than you, because I had to be better than you to be good enough. And, you know, somewhere in the midst of that, I'm at a huge party in Venezuela. And even though I was convinced for several months that I wasn't going to drink, I wasn't going to drink, and I wasn't going to drink, I'm sitting on a couch in this amazing party, and just food and barbecue smoke and merengue and salsa and confetti and women dressed and men impeccably dressed. And I'm sitting there, and somebody comes by with, you know, like a rum and coke. And it was just a horse of a different color. I was used to the red car, you know, cup in the back of a yard with a keg or whatever. And I just had the mental blank spot, and I took a sip, and it was like, all of a sudden my head started screaming at me. You're only going to have one. Just screaming. Like I'm trying to shove the will of right here, right now, the first sip of whatever that is to the end of the drink. Wendy, you are not going to have two. And, my friend Bob says that it's like I entered into a contract, Wendy at the beginning of the drink with Wendy at the end of the drink, and I'm not going to drink a second drink. And in reality, I get to the end of the drink, and Wendy at the end of the drink just says, Wendy at the beginning of the drink overreacted, I'm going to have another drink. I'm 2-3 drinks in, and suddenly I realize, you know, even though I've been silent for the last 4 months, I speak phenomenal Spanish. And I start talking to people, and the family I was living with, even though I was a dish rag of a sucked up, now anorexic alcoholic, I was like 135 by then, which for me is thin. I had just pale and, you know, and lifeless, you know, and because not only was I not having the spirits of the bottle, I wasn't having the spirits of food or anything else, you know, and by the time I'm 5 drinks in, somebody's twirling me around the dance floor, and I'm convinced that I was meant to be Latin. And then I, you know, by the time I get to, the next morning when I come to or wake up, whatever it is, I'm telling myself, Wendy, you made too big of a deal out of this. You know, you had a wonderful time last night. For the first time you connected to these people, everyone loved what you had to say. You had everyone's attention. And I just said to myself, you know, I'm just going to enjoy the holiday season, just the Christmas season. And when I have to go back to Catholic girls school, on January 4th, I'll just throw it into fifth gear again. I'll do what I did before. But there's a part, my very favorite part in the big book, you know, in chapter 4, that first paragraph. And if you're a fan of the 20 questions, I hold nothing against you, but my personal favorite, the two questions that actually nail it for me. And I'm going to screw up the exact saying, cause I'm not one of those people, but it's something to the effect of that. If you cannot stop when you want to, or if you cannot control your drink, or if you cannot stop when you want, you're probably alcoholic. And I could not control the amount I drank that night. And I was planning, I was convinced that on January 4th, I was going to stop. And I remember I, you know, got up that morning and I went to put on my Catholic schoolgirl uniform, and it's what you remember. It's plaid. It's imagine it's plaid. It's, you know, the pleated, it's the whole thing. And I went to zip it up and I gained 40 pounds. And yep. Cause that's how I roll, go bigger, big home. I saw some people just with a shocked expression. I could do it tomorrow. I mean, it's just not an effort. You know, and I remember, you know, just telling myself, not even telling myself, just a feeling came over me. I can't face people. I can't share this. I mean, as much as I was always kind of a talker, I was always saying things, there was no tether between what I was saying and what was going on the inside until you gave me the words, until I got here. I mean, then it was years into this process before I learned to express the truth at all. You know, I just kind of blotted out the rest of my time in Venezuela. You know, at first they were concerned. I was telling them what they wanted to hear. Then they were concerned. And I was like, oh, they don't understand. They're just not as sophisticated as I am. I'm from the US, you know? And, then they were just kind of like had to let go. And if I died, you know, hitchhiking in South America in the '80s, well, so be it. I got to tell you, if I forget, I've made an amends with that family and I just adore them. I am Aunt Wendy to all the daughter's children. And, I just, you know, that means a lot to me that we're connected today. They're all in Miami now because of Venezuela, but, I just want to tell you though, that I didn't see it. I continued that pattern for the next 20 years of my life. I went from, Venezuela to San Diego, tried some college in San Diego, decided that maybe that wasn't for me. I was supposed to be blue collar, moved to Denver, was in Denver. I met him. He had a big smile. And then I found my way to New York. I'm in New York for a couple years. And then he moves to Miami and I tell him a story and I'm going to meet him in Miami. I'm with him. Then I go to Frankfurt and then I end up in Victorville and then I go to Pomona. Each time I'm there 2 years, each time I'm not really taking people from the previous place to the next place because they're going to taint the well. Each time I'm going to reinvent myself, each time taking a trip is the answer. And I got to tell you, the guy that I followed from Denver to New York City to Miami, you know, he had no idea I was following him. I mean, I'm truly, that's who I am. I mean, honestly, I got to tell you that truly Glenn Close ruined it for us because until that movie, that was our game. I mean, it was my game. I really, really believed that I was going to find a place. I was going to find a place that just I belonged, you know, and I was going to recapture that feeling of Venezuela. Like I meant to be Latin, you know. It's funny because I share that story about Victorville. Marty says, Wendy, Victorville was the bottom. And nobody loves that story more than AA and Victorville. The women there had me up for a luncheon benefit, and it was really cool. So that they laughed so hard. You know, after I get back to Pomona, I rally the troops. I'm going to get sober, and try to get my degree, white knuckling it. And then I'm drinking on the weekends and it gets worse. And finally I get the big job at the end of the degree, in computer science. And it's like the dot-com boom, which is why I identify with Bill's story so much. His is the Industrial Revolution. I'm the seething and swelling of tech, you know? And within a year and a half, I was back to two cases of beer a day. And that is where I got when the cab driver brought me to you. But I want to say that I left you at the point when he flipped open the book in front of me, Jim, the cab driver, because this is how AA has always worked for me. Wherever two or three are gathered, there he is in the midst. Your agenda could be something entirely different. Somehow when we're together, there is something that happens in the midst of us that carries the message to me. Because when I got to AA, I got to tell you, I knew alcohol was a problem. I didn't know that it was revealing every problem. And I didn't know that I really belonged here. I thought I loved you guys and I was going to sit around here and tell you what you needed to hear, but I thought maybe it wasn't me, you know? But then he takes the book and he flips it open to chapter 3 and he highlights taking a trip, not taking a trip, which showed me that I belonged, that I was absolutely meant to be here. And he wasn't doing it because he knew my story. He had never heard my story. The man, like 2 days before, met me as I was a fare in his cab. He was doing it because his name was Jim Tripp. And he just wanted me to remember who he was. And I got to tell you, that's exactly what I think happens here. When we take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, there is a power, there is a something here that moves us somewhere to where there's a need. There's a crevice we each fill. And I don't know what that is. I just know that I try sometimes with the reminder of my sponsor, to let that be, that I don't need to direct you. You might try to direct me and I might try to accommodate you even, because today I don't have the strength to fight anymore that I did, but which is nice, which is really nice. Sobriety has been amazing. I'm just going to get into this. It took me a couple years to get willing to do what you do. And my misery was refunded. I got willing to do what you do and not read the book, but do the book after a couple years of just sitting in meetings and having a seed planted. It was a valid phase of my life. I needed to have the seed planted of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got convinced, when I convinced myself in the last little hurrah where I'm drunk in bars, telling bartenders how important the ninth step is in Alcoholics Anonymous and not being able to stop when I wanted to again, I called Women of AA and they cleaned up my house and they picked me up from the hospital and they took me to a meeting and a woman drove for 2 hours and it was like August. So it was like 107 degree heat or whatever. And she wanted to have, we're taught you go on a 12 step call, you take a second person with you. And so the woman she took with her, the second person smoked and she had to, as a condition of bringing her along, let her smoke in the car. So I love you. And drove me to this indigent detox in Orange County. And they told me to change your playmates, your playgrounds, and your playthings. And I did. And I've been here ever since. Orange County was not my idea. I just started doing what they said, like only the desperate can. And I remember telling my sponsor, screaming on the phone. And I would just be like, Patty, they hate me. And she said, well, tell them. And so I would get in a little circle with these giants of 60 days sober. And I would just be like, I don't think you guys like me. And I remember someone looking up to me, just a young girl. And she just kind of looks up and she goes, I feel the same way. And that's exactly what the power of this is for me. It's that one day at a time, we walk hand in hand on that broad spiritual highway. And I'm not alone because you tell me, you know how I feel, that I'm not different. And there is something so powerful in the fact that I'm like you, that I can share honestly and openly with you and not feel alone. I found my place. And so I became, you know, I sort of came to the understanding in being honest with myself or being honest with you that the gift of step one for me was honesty. That if I was going to stop fighting in step two, if I was willing to believe in step two, and I was going to come to a place where I was not going to fight the belief system that I had, the issues with God, it meant that I had to trust that I'm not a stepchild, that he doesn't make junk, that somewhere there's a fit for me. And I thought that, you know, like a puppy, we all love puppies, you know, but puppies pee on the rug sometimes. Like I've had some stuff that I had to clean up. And so I would share crazy in meetings, you know, and I'm just kind of like, by the time I'm 3 years sober, I'm a bleeding deacon. I got real involved in H&I because I felt like it was the only place I was wanted. But at the same time, I knew it was better than you. And I was the first person to take a transgender meeting into the federal prison here. And I, you know, my Spanish isn't great, just like it wasn't when I was there, but they were engaged and they would help me along. And, you know, we would read the book and it was wonderful. And I had that for 13 years and it kept me glued here for a very long time. And then by the time I'm 6 years sober, my sponsor at the time, I've had five sponsors, by the way, I'm not great at connections with human beings. I bless you if you are, but, it's taken me a little bit to have a true relationship with another human being. And the sponsor who I dearly admire at the time started traveling and speaking all over the world. And I got to tag along with her and I started meeting all these people. And people that I met in Sweden said that we're starting a young people's committee. And would you take the banner to San Francisco to the international thing? And I did. And then I met some more young people from Orange County. It was a couple and they were really involved in this big young people's meeting convention. And they were the chair and the co-chair and they broke up. And so they asked me to fill in as the co-chair. And I was like, yeah. And before you know it, I'm dancing and I'm having a great time at this young people's convention. And there's a bunch of 18-year-old boys dancing around me going Oppa Gangnam Style. And then I, you know, didn't plan on it, you know, but as I'm walking one day at a time, trying to be of service, showing up, you know, for meetings, sticking my hand out to the newcomer, sponsoring, reading the book. And I've never not been consistent here, just quite frankly, because I'm just too crazy, I think. Jim Hogan is out there and he'll attest to that. He's probably nodding behind the screen. But I literally was able to get to a place where my credit score was like an 800 and I could buy a house, you know, in doing all of these right actions, my life got taken care of without my knowing. And I bought a house and a few little bit later, I met the love of my life at a wedding. It was an AA wedding in Tijuana and his name is Churro. He was a puppy, he was 4 weeks old. And I just loved this little guy more than I could ever imagine. He was not my idea, but you guys swarmed me and you said, you can take care of him. You can do this. And because my idea was I was going to foster. I was a failed foster. He owns everything. He's got a boogie board. He's got a life floaty vest. He goes to something called OC Pup Scouts Daily, where they come and pick him up during the day for to go on a hike with other dogs. I mean, he's spoiled. This year, things got real, you know, and I found myself at a place where, you know, COVID hit. I got fired from my dream job. And the gift of that wasn't that I got fired, but that I realized I finally had connections to people that I truly loved that I worked with. And then I worked really hard to get another job. And 2 weeks after I started that job, I got diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. And I got to tell you, there was a moment of absolute terror that had I not been a day at a time in the footwork of Alcoholics Anonymous, with the brainwashing, quite frankly, that I needed to do the things that I was taught to do here, I might not have be sober right now. And by the, you know, inches and seconds, as Norm Alby used to say, I remember I called my neighbor, she showed up. I was terrified when I got the news and I fell on the floor screaming and crying, able to breathe, but barely. My sponsor, my neighbor who's in the program, friend of mine, put my sponsor on FaceTime and I said to her, I just looked at her and I screamed at her and I just said, you've got to let me go get something. You have got to let me go to the hospital and take something. I can't take this. Okay, gotta cancel that. Sorry. And she said, let's wait 10 minutes. And sure enough, I did. I waited 10 minutes. The oncologist called. He told me that, you know, there's hope. You're going to be okay. And I'm here still. you know, but if it weren't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't know that. I'm just going to end with this, that there's a part in the brochure, you know, that we have a member's eye view of Alcoholics Anonymous, where they say at the very end, and it's, we share the good news. And the good news is that the deaf hear, the blind see, and the lame walk again, or yeah, I screwed that up, but whatever, it doesn't matter. I love you guys. Thank you for having me out. It's been a joy.
Thank you, Wendy. May we now have the announcement.
We celebrate AA birthdays at this meeting. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything that would affect you from the neck up. If your regular attender of this meeting would like to take a cake with us, please email our scribe at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org.
Hi, I'm Ann, and I'm an alcoholic.
And please email her by 6:30. Otherwise, you have to wait until the following week to get recognized. We have several birthdays tonight. This week, we have a special guest to sing us our birthday song.
Hello, Xander Alcoholic. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. Now all you A&As, yeah, happy birthday to you.
All right, now.
Keep coming back. Sober.
All right, our birthdays this week are as follows. We have Hannah W. for 1 year. Her sponsor is Kara L. We have Joe B. for 7 years. Her sponsor is Lydia W. We have Chris H. for 11 years. His sponsor is Dave W. We have Thomas L. for 16 years. His sponsor is Chris N. We have Nancy S. for 23 years. Her sponsor is Tony C. We have Tim J. for 23 years. His sponsor is Jonathan S. We have Esther S. for 28 years. Her sponsor is Sia F. We have Kimberly K. for 38 years, former secretary. Her sponsor is Mary M. We have Cindy C. for 44 years, former secretary. Her sponsor is Tom W. So we had 9 birthdays for a total of 191 years, average being 21.22 years per cake. Happy birthday. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on your cake. At the end of the year, this money, candle money, is our contribution to AA organizations worldwide. If you wish to participate in this custom, please email our treasurer, Betty H., at treasurer@pacificgroupla.org.